Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Anyway, thank you all for being here, and thank you to the Bay Area Book Festival for creating this wonderful opportunity for people to come together at this intersection and talk about books. It is really a delight and a thrill, and this is my third year, and I couldn't be happier with how it's been going, and I'm really thrilled to have this group of people here because they are really global and regional in the same measure, i.e. all of them are global and able to understand the San Francisco Bay Area, which is rare. I've asked each of our panelists to do a self-introduction and to mention the first book review they ever wrote. It goes sometimes, it's weird and strange and fun. Okay, I'm going to begin with Paul.
Batter up. Hello, can you hear me okay? I'm Paul Lacey. Actually, I'm a book review editor, really, rather than a book reviewer, but I hope I can bring some insights into the whole process. I do the occasional review. And started off as a book review editor at the London Review of Books, a wonderful magazine where I was there for a dozen years. But now I'm at the Guardian newspaper, where I commission the non-fiction book reviews. And I'm trying to think back. I can't really remember the first book I reviewed, or even the first book review I commissioned, but I do remember those first months going to the LRB, the London Review of Books in Bloomsbury in London, and just suddenly being in this small office, but surrounded by people who knew so much, and copy was coming in from esteemed critics, the likes of Frank Kermode and Edward Said and Christopher Hitchens, and I just couldn't believe it. I was just, you know, I was transported into a different place. Very, very excited. And it wasn't that long before I was asking Hilary Mantel to review books about the French Revolution. And these pieces were coming in which seemed to take, to take reviews to a different level of kind of prose and insight. So I can't remember a particular book, but I do remember within weeks of my arrival at the LRB, we published a piece by the literary critic Terry Castle, I'm sure you know. And she was writing about Jane Austen and Jane Austen's intimate relationship with her sister, Cassandra, how they shared a bed, as people did in the late 18th century. But for some reason or somehow it got picked up, and Was Jane Austen Gay was a headline that was picked up by the tabloid press. And Terry Castle was finding herself interviewed on the British TV. And so that was a little sort of silly, entertaining insight into how even a small literary magazine that thought of itself as being, you know, in a particular place in the literary world could start a conversation, however unsophisticated a conversation. But it was a very entertaining little insight and introduction into that world.
Thank you. Terry Castle, underappreciated author at Stanford, right? I'm John McMurtry. I'm the book editor at the local paper, The Chronicle, which I think is co-sponsoring or sponsoring this festival. I was not paid to say that, though I should be. And I did have to think about the first book I reviewed, and I remembered it. I think I probably tried to not, or tried to forget it. A book by Barney Frank, I think it was called Speaking Frankly, and it was... Exactly. You can only he could use such a title. If you remember the former congressman from Boston area, and I think I was terrified to review this book because I covered him, and as a doing local politics for this Boston area weekly, and I remember actually the man who I can't remember his name who sat to my right. He once got off of the phone with Barney Frank, and he looked very ashen, and he had said that Barney Frank said, "I hope you're not planning on making a career out of this." That was the kind of guy Barney Frank was. So, but I think that probably he was. I never went to journalism school, but he probably served as a good professor in the way that he could insult you and really take you to task on things. And it was also a lesson, I believe, in something I hope that we'll talk about our culture now with a lot of reviewing, a lot of positive reviews in social media and wanting to be liked, the obsequiousness that we see a lot. And so I think I probably wrote a very favorable review knowing that it was Barney Frank and it had to be important. So that was my spiel.
Hello. My name is Lydia. I want to thank Jane for inviting me to be on this panel. This is very... Oh, okay. How about now? Are we good? Okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. I would like to thank Jane for asking me to be on this panel. It's really an honor to be with these people up here, and thanks to Shimi and the other organizers and people working here. My name is Lydia. I'm the editor of a book website called The Millions. I got started as a, I guess, reviewer. It's funny to call myself that, but here we are in what I believe is now called the golden age of blogs. I was sort of at the tail end of that. I started a personal blog on WordPress about reading the top 100 novels in English as decided by the Modern Library imprint. And so I just started working my way through them, and I wrote these little very facetious capsules about them that I don't recommend anyone read now. And actually, actually, you can't read them now because that blog is locked away in the WordPress cave. But a man named Max McGee, who ran his own sort of personal book interest website called The Millions, had a lot of friends who were readers and started asking them to contribute to his site. And one of those friends I knew casually, and he said, well, why don't you write one of these things for The Millions? And so I started doing that. And then Max asked me to come aboard as a staff writer, which is really kind of a hilarious label. It just meant we might get $11, sort of split 20 ways. Based on the kind of monetization models that existed at that time. And there's not much more money in it now, but there is a little more. Max has done a wonderful job growing the site from just this kind of personal quirky blog into something that, you know, we try and think of as a magazine, you know, even though we don't have any of the kind of resources behind us that we'd like to think magazines do, although magazines probably feel like they don't have any resources either. So that's how I got started. It was very informal. There was no kind of handbook for, I didn't consider what I was doing to be reviews. So I made a lot of, I'd say, mistakes kind of in the beginning. The Millions started growing just at the time that book publicists started understanding that the internet was something that was going to be useful for them and for their authors. And so I would start getting emails from publicists saying, oh, you know, can I send you this book? And I would say, sure. And then I assumed once I had the book that I had to say something about it, which I now know is not true. The first review I ever wrote that was commissioned, an editor named Dan Coyce, who's a wonderful man from Slate, he found me, and I was a grad student, and he said, you know, can you review this novel for us for Slate? And we'll give you, I think it was $200. And I was just elated and terrified, and then I read the book and I really didn't like it at all. And I had, you know, I didn't know much at that point, but I still had learned enough that if you don't have something nice to say, it's not necessarily wise to say it, especially if it's a debut novel. And so I was walking a fine line that I think all reviewers have to walk sometimes, where you're trying to describe the book. I was probably a little bit snarky about it. That's something that happens, and so I've now learned a little bit more about how to approach that. But that's my reviewing story, and here's Ishmael.
Testing, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm Ishmael Muhammad. I'm a staff writer at The Millions. I make $11 per review. and a contributing editor, Ed Zizova. I just like kind of started book reviewing in the last 2 years, so I'm gonna go like further back. The first review I ever wrote was in college for my college paper, and it was when Freedom came out, and like Freedom was like a big deal, and I got to write about it for the book review for the Columbia Spectator, and that was back when like Gawker was kind of the way young people learned how to write. A lot of us like just learned to write in college by reading Gawker, which meant we like all wrote kind of mean-spirited, smarmy reviews. So I wrote a review that like panned Jonathan Franzen as like a 20-year-old, which is ridiculous. And I remember after I, like a few days after I wrote it, I was walking in Riverside Park and somebody saw me because we had like our little, these like capsule photos next to our reviews. And somebody was like, who are you to like pan Jonathan Franzen? Like, you're nobody. I don't really write smarmy negative reviews anymore. But I hope I don't write overly positive, obsequious ones either. That was a lesson in avoiding kind of smarminess, I think.
Thank you. My first review begins with a car crash. And it's not because I'm doing a Dennis Johnson panel this afternoon. I was writing a column for Parade magazine covering international politics, Washington, D.C., you know, all the politicians there, and the movies. So I was out of the country about a third of the year, and I was interviewing movie stars and heads of state and heads of NATO and running around Cuba trying to find a Black Panther who hijacked a plane out of Oakland. I interviewed him. And then I was in a taxi accident. I was rear-ended at 57th Street and 7th Avenue in New York, and I could no longer work in that manner. So over the year or so that I learned how to get, you know, I was able to get back on my feet half of a day. I had half a day in bed and half a day up. I started reading an Alice Munro's collection. And I studied creative writing at Stanford. So I'm reading Alice Munro, and I'm thinking she's Canadian, and I'm thinking Wallace Stegner is Canadian. But people don't think of him as Canadian. They think of him as an international talent. So I decided, I got on a kind of a mission. So I sent a note to a guy I'd known in New York who is now at the LA Times, Steve Wasserman, who was the book editor at the Los Angeles Times. And I felt like I had to give him my sort of background in literature, so I told him about my graduate studies and blah, blah, blah. And he said, sure, do it. So I got very excited, and I wrote this thing that says, you know, she is a treasure for the world and so forth. And he put it on the front cover. So I went, oh, I can do this. I can read a book while lying down and get up at the computer for a couple of hours, and I can do this. So that's how I wrote my first review. In the years, maybe a decade or 12 years, sadly, a lot of the places that I began to look to review, like the Boston Globe and the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times and many others, Chicago Tribune, I couldn't make a living writing for them. So that's a sad part. So what I do now is I write a column for BBC Culture monthly, and I write a column for the Literary Hub, which is an online publication. If you don't know about it, Google it, because it's a free thing, and you can sign up and read all kinds of literary things on it. And NPR and some others. So that's a way I can piece together a living. And sadly, I don't write for the ones that are totally print. I'm totally online now. So that's how we all started. What? Oh, thank you. And the Chronicle, sorry.
Not to make a living.
Right. One way not to live. I mean, thank you. Thank you. It's like, ooh. So what I've asked is, we're going to do kind of a breakout a little bit. The assigning editors, because I think there's a process, as you know. How do you go about deciding who's going to write a piece? So I'm going to ask our assigning editors on the panel to talk a little bit about that process. I think I'll begin this time from the left with Lydia, and then move to this way. And then Ishmael and I can talk a little bit about what it's like to be on the other end, not assigning. Okay.
Well, I suspect my process is a little bit different from my colleagues here, because The Millions has almost no money, and I don't really do assigning in the sense that I, you know, look at what books are coming out and say, well, we have to have a review of this book on the side, and I've got to find someone to do it, and I'm going to ask someone and pay them, which is what I assume, but I hope to be educated about the process, is about for newspaper editors. But I have to rely on... So this is a two-part thing. The first thing I'm going to say, which is might be kind of depressing, is that we found people don't really read reviews, at least on our site. And I know some of my peers in the book website universe have found the same thing, that, you know, even if it's a really sort of big book that everyone has already heard of and already knows to anticipate, so to speak, then they will probably look at a review, which is unfortunate because you'd hope a review would sort of bring attention to books that people might not know about already. But unfortunately, we find when we do run those kinds of reviews, even if we have the sexiest headline possible and, you know, some alarming photo to accompany it, it just doesn't really find that much traction in terms of clicking, to use that horrible word. So and I find this also as a reviewer, you know, when I pitch individual books to editors, they usually aren't that interested. So for that reason, we don't run a lot of standalone reviews, or we try not to, and look instead for sort of survey essays, things that kind of look at a group of books or make some very persuasive and specific argument about a particular book. Or, you know, there's always the case someone has is either so enthusiastic in a way that goes beyond obsequiousness and is really kind of demonstrating some true passion for a book and can argue that very well, or the reverse, they just absolutely hate it and have written some beautiful hatchet job, which is very rare. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that would work as a review. But because we have no money, have to be a little bit creative with how we do things. So I have a policy. I won't ask someone to write, and, you know, if I don't have money to pay them. So if there's a book that I think, you know, we have to have something about this on the site, it just looks so interesting, or people are going to want to come and read something about it, I will sometimes ask a staff writer if they are interested in covering it, and, you know, I'll say, oh, this either looks like it's right up your alley, or I'll just sort of offer it to everyone and say, does anyone want this? Or I will try and find a little bit of money, just a very sort of symbolic amount, like $25, and ask someone else who I know, who's a freelancer. Apart from that, I'm based on, this might seem like hair splitting, but although I will not ask someone to write for free, I will accept someone's free writing if they give it to me. So a lot of what runs at our site is, are things that just come over the transom from, a lot of students and people who are kind of trying to break into the online writing business, and, you know, either with book reviews or personal essays or the vaunted review essay, which is, that's what we always are looking for. So I just kind of look at what comes into my inbox, and if it sounds interesting or it looks like it's well written, I'll take it. And the one good thing about having no money and not having to, we don't have to be timely in the sense that some publications do. So I'm very happy if someone just comes into my inbox and says, I really love this novel by Iris Murdoch, and I don't think enough people talk about this particular novel by Iris Murdoch, and I would like to. And I will say, yes, I agree, and please, let's talk about this underappreciated novel by Iris Murdoch. And it would be really, really hard to go to, like, the New Yorker website and say, I've got to write about this. You would have to, you know, have some sort of broader rubric that you were putting it under. So that's one good thing about being sort of our quirky little website.
So, shall I? Lydia, I'm a little surprised that you talked about money, because certainly we're not offering much money, as you know, Jane. And that hasn't changed, I don't think. But I would think that nobody's doing this for the money, maybe one or two people. So that's what often happily surprises me. You ask someone, and I just ask someone to do something, and she said, well, she couldn't officially take the money as an academic or position, so you occasionally come across that. But the money that's not why they're doing it. So, yes, for me, so 8 contiguous tabloid pages, it's been the same amount of coverage for years. We don't have a pull-out section anymore. So there are books pages in the Chronicle on Sunday, and then we also have pieces during the week related to authors, author profiles, interviews, that sort of thing. And that's a different budget, happily. And I'm always trying to pull back and think of the general reader and have a good mix of fiction, nonfiction, memoirs, something historical, the James Comey book, for instance, and finding people that's the thing that I take the greatest pleasure in, that often I don't have enough time for. And one case in point that I hadn't been in touch with him in years, David Blight. He's a magnificent Civil War historian at Yale. He used to be, I think, a public school teacher. And I would recommend, he has something like a 25-part history that's online through Yale. You can listen to or see on video for free. And he brings in a lot of poetry and novels in his class. And there's a Kevin Young novel coming out in May or June. I forget which.
His collection
just
came out.
Just out, is that right? Or is it April?
Yeah,
April. I'm backing up a little bit. So he'll turn it in a little late, but we can be also like the New York Review of Books. Doesn't matter. A few months within that window. So I asked David, would you like to do this? And this is different for him because he's usually in historical texts, so he's going to review this novel. And so that having a different sort of pairing like that I like as well. Bill Rogers, who I liked as a marathon runner, wrote for me years ago about running, and I think his daughter helped him write the review. You never know what happens. But the job for me has changed a lot. In, say, more than a decade ago, it was strictly assigning reviews, finding people, but I'm covering books as a beat, so I'm also writing about bookstores, I'm opening, closing, how Comey's book is doing, let's see, Independent Bookstore Day, a little something on that. So it's I'm a newsman again, and so I'm taken away. It's both good and bad. I'm taken away from my job as a book editor, but it also keeps me knowing what's going on in the industry, I suppose. Yes, poetry, happily for, the past year, we have had a weekly column by David Roderick, a Berkeley poet. It's called State Lines, and the New York Times Magazine does this as well, but we centered on California poets, and there are so many he hasn't had to rotate any. So he'll choose one poem, run it in its entirety, ideally, with a little introduction, and it seemed to be appropriate for this moment to celebrate the richness of California culture in these times, as they say, and to go beyond the Bay Area, and sometimes these lines that you draw, if a poet is in the Central Valley, you know, you don't want to overlook somebody in Fresno or L.A. So that's one thing that I'm always looking for new features, columns. We have a weekly rotating independent bookseller column. They pick 8 or 10 books, and something I've been doing for the past couple of years as well is I ask people to write a short little something, 200-300 words on their most treasured book. One person just wrote about a book that he no longer owns because it was burned in his home, which burned in one country. So if anybody has ideas for features, rotating features, that sort of thing, I'm open to ideas, what you'd like to see on our pages as well, certainly. Paul?
I should say that I can't wait to hear what you all say about book reviews, how many reviews you still read, where you read them. Do you read them in print? Do you read them online? Do you find that reviews these days take a smaller place in the kind of ecosystem of literary journalism, if you like? So you find yourself reading more interviews or features than you do reviews. So I'm really fascinated to hear the other side of it. I mean, I'm lucky enough to work for a newspaper that still takes book reviews quite seriously. There is less money than there used to be, but there is still a little bit of money. I think there are two questions, aren't there? There are how do I choose the books that we review? Because hundreds of nonfiction books come across our desk pretty much every week or every fortnight, and we only have 6 or 7 nonfiction reviews every week. So that's a tricky business. And for me, just sort of quickly, before I go on to how the part that I love, which is matching the books to reviewers, in terms of choosing the books, it's a combination of things. I don't think any of this is that fascinating. It's the books that I think people will be talking about. So beyond any sort of hype provided by the publisher, it's the really books which might be part of national conversation. It's the books that I find interesting. It's the books that I think my readership will find interesting. Books that I know that particular writers could write amazingly about. But I think it's also there is because these books come across my desk, and because I get lots and lots of emails from publicists saying, please, will you review this book? Please cover this book. It's the thing I spend most of my time doing is sort of answering these emails. Or not. I mean, I try to. Then it's a case of, you know, you want not to be doing what everybody else is doing if you can possibly avoid it. So I think it's part of my responsibility to take books from new and emerging and small presses and academic presses, as well as the Penguins, as well as the places which have money and people to push things your way. But as I guess as a non-fiction assigner of book reviews, it's slightly different than when you do fiction, but you know, a portion of the book reviews that I assign are when you look for somebody with expertise. If it's a history book, if it's a book about moral philosophy, if it's a book about evolutionary science, if it's a book about Civil War history, as you were saying, then you need someone who can bring to bear that expertise on the book. It isn't just a case of somebody who can, anybody can do it if they can string a sentence together. They really need to know what they're doing. And that in itself is a joy because you, over the years, you build up a bank of reviewers. So, oh, that person knows about beards in medieval Wales, you know. That person knows about how an octopus feels to be an octopus. And you can ask these people who are not only expert, but they can write the kind of review that you're looking for, which is colloquial reviews, open, confident, wonderfully entertaining and fascinating, choosing the right examples from books, not mired in sort of stale reviewees language, not mired in jargon. If they're scholars, then you want to make sure that they can talk to a general public, as would be obvious. So, you know, if it's a book about ancient Rome, then I would call up Mary Beard and say, please write this book, and she can't always do it, but when she does, it's always a treat. If it's a book about British politics, then I might ask the playwright David Hare, who's written plays about British politics, and he writes these wonderful reviews. If it's a book about, I don't know, attitudes to death or parts of the Second World War, then I might phone up the wonderful historian here in Berkeley, Thomas LeCur, and he writes these unparalleled, thoughtful pieces about such things. And, you know, that for me is a real pleasure in the job. And as I say, we don't have much money, but we can offer these people a certain amount of cash to write the reviews. And we do have one or two staff writers or contract writers who, as well as writing other things, they write a certain number of reviews a year for us. Catherine Hughes, Blake Morrison, on my pages, and so it's a varied process, but it's a very enjoyable one.
I'll say quickly, sorry, with people bemoan the state of newspapers, but one good thing is we do live online as well, so there are no limits there, so you can go at length in the way you can't do in print, and then you can also introduce something I think you've talked about, video reviews, that sort of thing. I haven't delved into that Ron Charles territory. I recommend those. I think he does these monthly, totally hip book reviews. He and his wife put a lot of work into them. So there's that outlet as well.
Ishmael. I think this works. Oh, that works now. Oh, great.
Okay, testing again. We're good.
Okay.
So I tend to freelance, and I'm a PhD student at Cal, so those situations kind of shape my reading life and what I tend to write about. I look for books that I can speak in an informed way about. So I study American literature broadly and African American literature specifically. So I tend to write mostly on texts that are within kind of like the broad tradition of American literature in the 19th and 20th century. but I don't have a lot of time, and because I'm in the program right now, and I get a lot of books and emails these days, so I tend to look for books that people are interested in reading about that have some kind of like hype about them. The recent Zadie Smith collection, for example, or last year, the Jesmyn Ward novel. Because when you're freelancing, as Lydia said, people don't really want to get reviews about obscure debut novels or experimental texts. If I pitch people reviews on a new book from New Directions, oftentimes, like at Slate or The Nation, people just don't want to pay for those things, unfortunately. And so it means I'm forced to write about bigger books, more popular books.
I'll take them.
Good to know. I'm trying, but that's unfortunate to me because now that I have a bit of a reputation, I get a lot of emails from publishers working with African American authors who just aren't getting a platform to for their writing, for interviews or reviews, or even just like capsule reviews. And I want to be reviewing those people because nobody else is really doing it. There are like three recent short story collections that are all excellent. One is by Jamel Brinkley called A Lucky Man. I'm going to tell these to you so you buy them and read them. Jamel Brinkley's A Lucky Man. Nafisa Thompson's The Heads of the Colored People, which is incredible. And John Edgar Whiteman has a new collection now called American Stories. They're all fantastic. Nobody's reviewed them at all. He did get a review? Oh, okay. I retract that. but like it's sad to me that they're not getting much play out there. So I'm trying to figure out a way to kind of like work those people into my freelancing practice. The other way I get reviews is through assignments from editors. Those are difficult because I think I began my career writing about African-American texts and kind of like political issues around white supremacy and racism. And I think given the state of our politics, people are like really desperate to find people to write on those topics, and so I get a lot of just like, here's like random black book, write about this, like irregardless of your actual interest or talents or knowledge, which I just don't appreciate. So I often end up I'm saying like, okay, like cool, this Van Jones book, not interested in writing about that, although he's I appreciate Van Jones. I'd much rather review this like new Otoisa Moshfegh book or Zadie Smith because I actually know something about those texts and I can also speak to like our political context via those reviews. I tend towards the review essay and not individual reviews because people don't want individual reviews oftentimes. So I tend towards essays that are about, you know, book A in a particular context, right? Or a group of books within a particular context that I think demonstrate a certain tendency or are talking about something that we need to be talking about as a culture. Yeah, but I'm also kind of on the like early end of my career. So I'm still hustling, I guess. And things are not as easy as I would like them to be, and I think that that's also the context in which I'm writing. And maybe if I were 5 years down the line, I wouldn't be getting like Van Jones books sent my way necessarily. I came up in the business in part through the National Book Critics Circle Emerging Critics program, which has been an incredible.
The first class of
the Emerging Critics. It's been very helpful. It's been putting me in contact with a lot of editors across the country. I'm also now a board member at the NBCC, so it worked out pretty well.
I'm going to hang on to this because I can't figure out how to get that off.
I mentioned that because the National Book Critics Circle, of which I'm a We're an all-volunteer organization of 24 board members, and we run an awards program, and we run a website, and we do all this on mainly under $15,000 a year. And our only income is member dues, and members are about $50 a year. So that's how we go, and you can find out more about us at bookcritics.org. But we created the Emerging Critics Program last year because we wanted to bring along people who were interested in book criticism but might not know what the path is, because it's kind of complicated these days. So we had a group. There's also Heather Scott Partington up in Sacramento, and Ishmael. We were very happy to spread, also move beyond the East Coast. So we have a range of those first-time critics, and they were had the opportunity. I mentioned this because there may be somebody in this audience who wants to apply for this, and it's if this the second year is going on right now, we have our submissions, but you can also apply next year. And it allows people to have Skype conferences with various members of our board who are book editors or book reviewers, and learn an awful lot of information. So back to the topic where I'm going to wrap up this one second topic for us. I actually, like these guys, I get hundreds of books. And my husband can attest to it because we bring them in and open them. And then we discard the cardboards. I'm sort of, I have a, I'm a, I tend to be, I'm an optimist. So I pick up every book and I read the first couple pages. And I kind of try to ignore the publisher's name and the author's name and the whatever. I mean, you can't ignore some, you know, okay, this guy already won an award or this woman already did this. But I open and I find myself making decisions about what I'm going to put in my BBC column based on two things. Is it really great, and does it deal with my 50% American readers and my 50% global readers? So I will, for instance, include in my column a book by a Croatian author called The Fox, which is really fascinating, or a book called The Aviator, which is coming up and I just fell in love with. It's an amazing, massive book that's sort of a Lazarus idea, but it's a young Russian, a guy wakes up in a hospital and doesn't know who he is or where he is. And his doctor says, hands him a piece of paper and pen, and says, start taking notes on everything you can remember. And he starts remembering, and his first taste of vodka, for instance, he realizes that they used to toast, we were born in the century, so he was born in 1900. So he remembers all this stuff about what went on, the Russian Revolution, his first love, and then he ends up in the Gulag. He remembers that. And then one morning he wakes up and he says, the pills by his bedside were manufactured in 1999. What happened? So it goes on. It's wonderful. So see, that's what happens. I mean, it came in the door. I never heard of the author. I picked it up, I started reading, and I kept going. So that's what happens for me. I'm just one of those people. And I am open to small presses, and I am open to work in translation. So those are two of the things that I do. I write a column for the Lit Hub on a weekly basis, which gives me an opportunity to also reach further in various ways. But I'm now starting a new column in a couple weeks that will be about the books in an author's life. And so far I've been having conversations with Paul Theroux, and Rahman Alam, Michael David Lucas, Francine Prose, Carol Black. Wonderful, interesting kind of conversations. And I'm feeling my way. I'm not sure how it's going to go. I mean, that's sort of like being, I love starting over. I'm an Aries, so it's like, oh, let's see what will happen here. Let's like try this. But anyway, but for 3 years I've done a thing called the Books Making News This Week, in which I really started out looking at what books were getting reviewed and who was saying what about them. And then I started doing a little bit of intro at the beginning to kind of think of who's winning awards and where do we stand on this particular Tuesday in the literary world. So after three years of Sunday deadlines, I now am released to try something new and have Thursday deadlines. So that's my story, and it really is mainly that I'm open, I'm an optimist. I will also throw a book across the room if it disappoints me. Oh, I have to think about it. Which was the last one I threw across the room? All right, okay. Let me think about it. It may have been a Franzen book, but then I had to interview him on stage, so I was like, that's kind of awkward, but I think I'm not the only person who sometimes has those moments. So, but it is a thing. I would also share with you, as a member of the Book Critics Circle, we sat down in March and had 24 members discuss our finalists, 30 finalists for six categories, and we argued. And some people hated the book and thought it was terrible, and other people loved it and thought it was brilliant and would last forever. So it's a thing about book critics, you know, and I have to be careful around the house and not get terribly critical about other things that are going on, you know. It's a thing you get, right? Do you guys have trouble with that? Oops, you know, I'm a critic, you know. I couldn't help it. All right. Speaking of, now we're moving into bad books. What do you do with bad books? I'm going to just start out quickly. I reviewed a book by a woman who was living in California at the time. And it was a book from the point of view of a Guatemalan genocide perpetrator who is now a trash man in Los Angeles. Okay, can you hear me now? Okay, it was a book about a Guatemalan genocide perpetrator who was living now as a trash man in Los Angeles from his point of view. I hated it. I read it three times to make sure that I had this feeling and that it was okay. And I wrote a really bad review, and I spoke about this at an event with Dale Peck, who was the one who took down Rick Moody, calling him the worst writer of his generation, and he didn't apologize. I didn't apologize for hating the book and saying that it was a mistake. I did apologize for adding the books that you should read instead at the end of my review. So that's my confession.
That's okay. Does anybody do bad reviews anymore? It seems that those are. It started, I think, with BuzzFeed. There's a model, I think, The Believer, elsewhere, where maybe it's not good for business, or maybe there's a tendency to not want to offend. But of course, implicitly, by not reviewing a book, does that mean you didn't like it? So you're making a statement as it is. The Sean Penn book got a lot of press, and I wasn't asked to review it, and that's really not, thankfully, done. I don't know if you're asked by, you don't have to answer, but I do remember once or twice, you might want to look at this one. You know, no pressure. But it was suggested that I talk to Sean Penn about this book, because it was, and I interviewed him 15 years ago, I think, about a play that he was in San Francisco. And that was fine, but I really didn't want to do this, talking about this novel. But they asked me because it was because of traffic, and they wanted to. It's a Sean Penn book. So that, I think, we have to resist, because it's a bad book, and yet Sean Penn wrote it. Therefore, we need to treat it. And it's too easy also to just have fun with it, negatively review it, and... I'm not quite sure. The Times piece was fun. So that's one that quickly came to mind.
We used to call it malicious obedience. Yes. We used to call it malicious obedience. When your boss says, I want you to do this, and you say, yes, sir, and you do it in a way that he might not be happy with, or she might not.
Right,
be.
Right.
Yes.
Let's see if I can remember this. It'll come to me, a short review that somebody, A.O. Scott, did for the Times. Yes, it was about palindromes, the movie, and it was backwards or forwards, a dud. I just love that. Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
That's a good one.
This is just random, but I miss him. Alan Chu's reviewed for many newspapers, NPR, and he's been gone for a few years, but he wouldn't say this on air. In terms of all the books that we get, he was spinning the line that Orson Welles had, who do I have to fuck to get into this movie? And with Alan, it was who do I have to fuck to get off this mailing list? That's what he told me.
Everyone loves a really entertaining negative review, I think. And I think they're extremely important as well, that not just to have reviews which are positive. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of pressure to say, okay, let's feature the books which we think are wonderful. Let's feature the books which we think will make people happy when they read them. But I think there's something else that needs to be preserved, and that's a particular response to a book from someone who one hopes is in a reasonably good position to judge, and to point out its faults and to say it doesn't do what it set out to do. And I tend to feel that negative reviews, hatchet jobs if you like, I like them in direct proportion to the size of the reputation of the author of the book, if that makes sense. And I think for me personally, I mean, again, I'm interested to hear what other people feel about this. I wouldn't be very enthusiastic about a hatchet job for a debut book writer, a novelist or a non-fiction writer. I think the best thing to do in that situation is probably to wait for them to publish another one. But it, you'd get yourself it's difficult waters, because if you commission a book review, you know, we don't have that much money to pay kill fees for reviews. So you don't, that's the one of the things that should be said. It's obvious, but you don't know what you're going to get when you commission these book reviews. Sometimes it's a book that you really hope that the reviewer is going to be positive about for your own reasons, to do with your own set of interests, and they are negative about it, and that puts you in a really sticky position, especially if the author of the book is someone who you also commissioned to write reviews and have interviewed. Or so it's a tricky business, but it's very important that I feel that books are judged in a way which doesn't just emphasize their good points. I mean, this introduces all sorts of other questions, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. You know, book reviewers, they're not like lawyers or accountants. There's not a professional qualification, really. There's no one to say that this person is more qualified to write about this book than anybody else, or someone who doesn't get paid to do it. So the whole business of, well, my view about this book is as good as yours, introduces all sorts of issues to do with the literary journalism online and the old days of these faceless, tended to be male authority figures pronouncing on a book, and there'd be no public conversation about that review apart from perhaps a letter from a reader a week after the review appeared in print. But, you know, I think that if you've got the right reviewer and you're confident and they come in with a negative review, then it's something to be cherished. You know, my job is to sort of probe that review, I think, a little bit and say, okay, why do you think that? To get them on the phone or to write them a series of email questions and say, look, this review might cause a bit of a fuss because it's a negative review. Let me make sure that we agree about your opinion. But I'll go back to where I started, in that they are among the most memorable book reviews you can read. I mean, I remember in the New York Review of Books, John Banville taking down Ian McEwan's novel Saturday. And people talked about it. In my small world, people talked about it for months. Zoe Heller wrote the most astonishingly wonderful negative review of Salman Rushdie's memoir, Joseph Anton, again in the New York Review of Books. And I'm not going to remember one of the lines, but it was something like, the world is as large and as wide as it ever was. It's just Salman Rushdie who's got small. because she felt it was...
Yeah.
And sometimes I think it's important that publications take a book that everybody else has praised to the skies And so there's an orthodoxy that's being built up. And just to inject the idea that there can be a variety of opinions about this book, they might find someone who genuinely and had a certain amount of sort of had been marinated in the world for long enough to be confident enough to say that they don't think it's as good as everybody else. There was a book, there was a review of the Richard Flanagan Booker Prize winner, and the review was by Michael Hoffman in the London Review of Books. And he said about that book that it lacks the basic dignity of prose. Which seemed to me to be going way too far. I mean, I don't agree necessarily with these reviews, but I think we can all agree that when they're done well, they're a lot of fun.
There's also a very English approach to doing this, too, which is different from, I remember, was it Hitchens tearing into Updike? Updike had his list of rules, I think, for reviewing, essentially being fair and finding a kernel of good within the book. And Hitchens would say that he was Mr. Congeniality. So there's that distinction, I think.
Bad reviews. Bad reviews.
It's interesting. I've only written one truly negative review, and it was for The Millions, and we're able to see from, we unfortunately, like many websites, are in an unholy alliance with Amazon, and that's one of the only ways that we've been able to kind of keep afloat. We're trying to extricate ourselves from that to the extent possible. Happy International or Independent Bookstore Day. That's today. Please go to an independent bookstore. But we can see from our Amazon links what books people are buying based on visiting our site. And that book, after my negative review, was the top of our bestseller list for 6 months. So I think there are certain types of books and certain types of reviews where it's sort of a victimless crime. Of course, you know, I'm sure the author who receives a review like that is always, it's going to be smart. But Sean Penn, I don't, no one's going to cry themselves to sleep because Sean Penn got a bad book, a bad review. You know, that's, again, to sort of reiterate what people are saying, I think if it's a first-time author who was not going to have much attention to their book anyway, then it's just pointless and cruel to post a bad review. That's so, yeah, I'll just say sometimes bad reviews can do as much for a book as a really glowing review, depending on what the review is like.
It's funny because I remember reading that review when I was in college.
I wouldn't write it again.
But that was like one of those things that like taught me how to write when I was in college. But like I said earlier, I don't do like hatchet jobs, in part because, again, I'm on the early end of my career, and so far editors have not wanted to receive those kinds of reviews for me. They're not interested in publishing those reviews for whatever reason. I'm an academic, and so I have a high tolerance for things that are like aesthetic failures or that are boring. If I think that like there's something interesting like at the heart of them, or if like they're working out interesting ideas, and so like I tend not to do like negative stuff, but like rigorous reviews where like I can work out the ideas that are happening or that are like at play in a novel or in an essay collection. And then, like, in the second half, like, list off the things that I think are, like, aren't working in the book. And it's just a way of, like, taking the book seriously and, like, rigorously and, like, thinking along with the author and trying to be generous. And, like, I have yet to write one of those, like, sublime sentences that just, like, shits all over a book. But also, like, I don't have a lot of time to read. And I don't spend time with books that I don't like. I just don't want to do it. I don't want to like think along with a book that I don't enjoy. So if I don't enjoy it, I'm just going to put it down after 100 or so pages. I definitely don't want to like sit and think about it for, you know, however long it takes to write a review. It takes me a very long time to write. And so I'm just not interested in doing that. So I can write a review of a book that I think is a failure in some aspects, but I'm going to do it in a way that like feels generous and rigorous. And maybe one day when I have like a job and I'm not freelancing, I'll like write some really great hatchet jobs.
The time is flying. I'm going to jump us ahead to a final topic, and we may not have time because I do want to give some time for you all to ask your questions. So I'm going to ask Ishmael to talk a little bit about the Ta-Nehisi Coates review that he wrote, and then the response to that, which included his responding to Cornel West's takedown of Coates. I mean, this is the kind of thing you can get into in this new world of social media, and you're online, and you're writing a review, and then something else happens. So tell us a little bit about that. Suddenly we're in a political context, but book critics were told not to get into politics or be activists, but suddenly we're in a new world. So anyway.
Yeah, I never heard the bit about like not being political. I'm at Berkeley again, so it's just like it's like what we do in that department. I got assigned the Ta-Nehisi Coates book. We were 8 years in power. I really think Coates is a fantastic thinker. I don't agree with him on everything, but I can like kind of engage with him rigorously. I enjoyed the book enough, and I tried to contextualize it within Coates' career as a public thinker. The book itself is a collection of essays that he published in the last decade, like 11 years, over the course of Obama's presidency. So if you've like followed Coates' writing at all, like you would have already read all of these pieces. There's like nothing new in them necessarily, aside from some like an epilogue and a few like introductory mini essays he affixes to each essay in the collection. So I wasn't really interested in writing a review of like the ideas in the book because there aren't new ideas. But I wanted to talk about what Coates means in this political moment, especially in regards to obviously our kind of recursion into explicit white supremacist racism. And I want to talk about like Coates as a thinker because people don't... people like want to attack him and like call him wrong for like whatever ideas he holds, but they don't like think about the kind of like overarching nature of his thinking across like the last 15 years. So also the review came out like 2 months after the book was released, so I had the luxury of like sitting back and like reading other people's reviews and being like, no, like you didn't get it. So I did that and it was well received. And about 2 months later, in December, Cornel West, who's like another great black thinker, he's a philosopher, professor at Yale now, I think.
He was at Princeton.
If you like are a black writer or thinker, like Cornel West is like the guy, right? So whenever something he writes comes out, you're like, oh yeah, I'm gonna read this Cornel West thing. He wrote this hatchet job on Ta-Nehisi Coates, calling him a neoliberal, a kind of stooge to white power, very nearly an Uncle Tom. It was very unfortunate. I didn't agree with it. I know a lot of people who did agree with it, but I just didn't think it was that good. I wasn't going to write anything about it because, again, it's like, who am I to write about Cornel West? An editor reached out and asked me if I wanted to do it, and I hesitated because I didn't want to be caught out in public denouncing like an elder statesman of black thought. But it seemed like an important thing to do just because what we think about books matters because like what we think frames how we think about our politics in a larger sense. And I think book critics are the only people who are, not the only people, but along with academics, obviously, are some of the people best positioned to like reframe how we think about our politics or frame them within a larger context that is often lacking, like online or on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or whatever. And so I feel like it's very important that academics get into the business of like speaking to the public, but also that book critics like reorient our practice so that we can not tell people how to think, but teach them how to think better and give them better tools with which to think.
Thank you. Thank you all. I think, I hope everyone's enjoyed this side of the table. Now we want to listen to you with your questions. Do we have a rule about questions? Do we have a mic going around? Okay. I'm going to start here. I'm going to go like that, okay?
Okay. I can talk loud. So since you are doing nonfiction, the thing you thought was boring, I thought would be one of the most interesting things, which is how you choose which books you think are going to become part of the national conversation, international conversation. So if you could, I was thinking of an example to work with. I'm sure you get a ton of books on climate change. It's a critical thing to be putting forward the right ones. Probably some of them that aren't as well written have critical ideas that haven't gotten out there. How do you, that, use that, could you use that as an example of what that process really is?
Yeah.
Really.
So I can probably talk louder as well. But this is working. So I think on an issue like that, which is clearly completely vital, and it should be. Oh, I'm sorry. So it was going back to how I decide which books that we're going to review, to commission a review. And specifically, for example, an issue like climate change, there's lots and lots of books that come out. Which, if I've got this right, which book would you choose in particular to cover, given all of the other books that are out there on that issue? And I think, I don't know how good a light this puts me in, but I think it would take a book that addresses the issue, but is also an author that people want to read. So take, say, for example, Naomi Klein. If she writes the book about that kind of subject, that's going to help the commissioning the review, because people would have known her reputation already. We know that she's a good writer. We know that she can take that issue and just communicate what's important about it to the audience that we're, the readership that we're seeking. So you would avoid the more scientific, the more dry, the more, however important, you would have to avoid those because you would have to think about your readership.
Okay, next question. Here.
Hi. I would like to explain. We're sitting up in front, and you've probably seen us signing. The two of us are deaf. We didn't have an interpreter for this event, and we tried with our iPads and our iPhones to use captioning, but it didn't work. So I guess I want to ask anybody here if they wouldn't mind sharing their notes from this event. We would really appreciate it. We're right here. Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
Hi, this is for anybody who wants to answer. I write reviews, and I have a small followership, but I don't tend to talk about language and sex and stuff like that in my reviews, but I do have followers who ask, do you, you know, is there sex in this book? Is there swear words? Stuff like that. I don't tend to think that that's important, because I think that overall you get ideas from books no matter whether they're censored or not, you know, they should be censored or not.
So those readers don't want to have sex or
yeah, they don't want the language or the sex in it.
Are you, any of you guys sensitive to this and concerned
should
about
I,
it?
Should I...
Not enough sex.
Should I write... should I write down the fact that there's sex and language in a book when I'm reviewing it, or just tell them I don't believe in censorship, so...
Well, for me, a family newspaper, I think it's just taste and profanity. There's a style guide you follow, but it's usually S long dash. But there are clever ways of rephrasing things. Again, they're usually English. saying them euphemistically, so...
No, just say family-oriented if you want to, or not family. Or, yeah. And then you...
You maybe come out over here. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question about the impact of book reviews? Paul mentioned the old days. My perception is that back when, you know, an Edmund Wilson or Lionel Trilling or even a Janet Malcolm could basically kill a book or raise it to the heavens with one review. Is that still true today? And if it isn't, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yes, it is, Paul.
Sounds like it's true.
I feel like it's not really possible because Twitter exists. And, I mean, I don't know, like, people don't particularly care what critics have to say. And, like, not in the same way. If somebody
can... Twitter kill books?
No.
Okay. There's Oprah Winfrey, sorry, I would cite as... She's the deal maker. I just interviewed Tayari Jones, and she's a respected author. This was her fourth novel, but when she was chosen, this changes her life for good, for now. Not just because she gets to go on cruises with Oprah Winfrey.
Thank you.
Again,
I'm just trying to grab one more question. You've been great. I mean, nothing personal. Time is going, oh my God. Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about children's books, please? Because that is a field where I think a lot of people read reviews to kind of check the material out for their children. And I was wondering if you assign books for review based on the author's credentials alone or whether they need to have a connection with the educational community or children before they would get that assignment. So do you approach it from both angles of how the child would read it as well as the parent would read it?
We have a monthly roundup of children's books. Susan Faust, she just retired as a school librarian. She'd been doing it for decades, and she's been reviewing for us for decades. Yeah, she's cool.
Guys, we have only 1 minute left. What shall we do?
Dance.
One more answer. Dance, okay.
I was just going to say that we haven't really talked about the changes in book reviewing ecosystem in the social media and the digital world. But in a sense, I think the children's reviews is one way that the web has made things much better because the print publications didn't really have enough space, I think, to cover children's book reviews. I've got two kids, 1 8, 1 10. They'd read a lot of books, and I can't keep up with them. And the place I go is the web. And there are lots of very fascinating and enlightened kind of reviewers on the web. So I think you don't need to be connected to education or something. I think, and you don't need to have an established name. I think people are always on the lookout for just an imaginative new children's book.
Thank you. I've learned a lot. I hope you all have. And I think... I wish we could keep talking, but I know they're going to kick us out of the room. So I want to thank you all for being here. And in particular, I want to say thank you to the guys up here. You've been very patient. You've been very informative. Sorry for cutting off a couple, but as time began to slide and I realized we were missing some of our things and we had to do some questions, that's the way it goes. But anyway, thank you very much to Ishmael and Lydia and John and Paul. Thank for you for being here, and thanks to Sherilyn and all the volunteers who create the Bay Area Book Festival. It's really remarkable, and this is a great start off for all of us. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.